The views expressed in this podcast are solely those of the speaker. This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not a substitute for professional medical advice from your own physician.
Hello, I'm Rajiv Saigal, neurosurgeon with University of California, San Francisco. I'm previously at the University of Washington. Today, I'm joined with Dr. Michael Feelings and Dr. Yi Liu. We're all members of the NASS section on spinal cord injury, and today we'll be talking about some modern topics in management of spinal cord injury.
Michael Feelings, a professor of neurosurgery at the University of Toronto, and very pleased to participate in this session.
I'm Yi Liu, and I'm from Brigham Women's Hospital in Harvard, and very happy to be here asking the expert about the modern treatment for spinal cord injury.
So we were just chatting about some of the key topics that are important in spinal cord injury management. And one of the central issues is, of course, timing of intervention, timing of surgery. And Dr. Feelings, you've been involved with some of the key trials studying early management. Could you tell us your thoughts and how you decide about timing of spinal cord injury management?
The challenges now relate to how to actually implement these guidelines in the day-to-day practical management of this. And part of that challenge has spurred a recent effort that will be undertaken by AO Spine, hopefully with collaboration of NASS as well, to revisit the guidelines on the role and timing of a spinal cord injury.
So Dr. Feelings, is there any, there's some push for ultra early decompression surgery within 8 hours? Is there any strong evidence for that, or do you support that?
Yeah, so in concept, I would say that, you know, time is spine, and earlier intervention is better. You need to balance that against the logistics to make sure that the patient is medically stabilized, that the imaging is done, that the operating theater is prepared, and so on. So, you know, if a patient is, you know, injured very close to the hospital, that may be indeed, feasible. You know, Sanjay Dahl and others have been kind of pushing for this ultra-early concept. Some of the European groups have done this. And I think if the logistics are there and if the patient is stable, it certainly makes sense to do this. Our recent publication in Lancet Neurology suggested that, in fact, there is an almost linear relationship between the timing of surgical intervention and the benefits. And so that it would appear that patients who are able to have ultra-early surgery within the first 8 hours, if you will, do have some incremental benefit over kind of delaying. And I think the principle here, and this is part of the challenge, is to balance the benefits of timing, but also to ensure that you have the imaging, the infrastructure in place as well. And I think one of the big challenges that we now face is how to take this principle and this guideline, but to adopt this into the realities of clinical practice and then to personalize this for the individual patient.
Could you tell me your thoughts on some of the practical limitations, sometimes ultra early or getting the patient in quickly?
Yeah, that's actually another question I have that's practically, I think one of the concerns for a lot of practicing spine surgeons is, so let's take for central cord syndrome as example. There is a natural decline of the patient neurologic functions with time, with the swelling of the cord. And how do you judge that? How, like, for example, if you do the surgery, patient woke up worse. How do you know that it's because of the surgery or because of the natural progression of that disease?
Yeah, so central cord syndrome is an interesting subtype. It's now become the most common subtype of spinal cord injury that we're seeing in North America and other developed areas of the world. So it's very relevant. And we do have emerging evidence that's yet unpublished that would strongly suggest that early surgical intervention for at least the more severe forms of central cord injury, specifically patients with an ASIA C injury do show an incremental benefit. It is difficult with existing outcome measures to show a clear benefit of early surgical intervention for milder forms of injury, the ASIA D, and it may in part reflect the limitations of the outcome measures. We may need more sensitive outcome measures. The phenomena that you're referring to where a patient has an evolving injury can occur potentially related to an ischemia reperfusion injury. And I think one of the ways to try to avoid this is with careful attention intraoperatively to avoid hypotension. And so if you have fluctuations in the spinal cord perfusion, that could potentially place the patient at higher risk for the ischemia reperfusion injury. Fortunately, as has been shown in modern surgical series, it's actually very uncommon for patients to decline following surgical intervention.
So I guess another issue is the, for example, the polytrauma patients. How do you judge between the timing of the bring the patient to the early surgery versus stabilize the patient with other kind of traumas?
So that's a very relevant question, and the kind of the time of spine Staskis principles apply best for patients where the main injury is a spinal cord injury. In the polytrauma patient, you now need to exercise considerable judgment. So there may be situations where the spinal injury is still the predominant injury, and that will take a precedent. But if patients have hemodynamically threatening injuries due to internal organ injuries, those will need to be managed first, and that will take priority over the over management of the spine fracture and the spinal cord injury. Sometimes you run into situations where you've got multiple services sort of competing to get the patient to the operating room. I think once you have dealt with whatever is immediately life-threatening, though, I think that it is imperative that serious spine fracture, particularly one with neurologic injury, be managed as soon as possible, because you are then going to run into secondary complications, and I think that really does need to be stressed.
I would say that in Seattle, that was our biggest limitation to taking spinal cord injury patients early, was the polytrauma, hemodynamically unstable patient. And I think basic principles of trauma management, airway, breathing, circulation apply. And we would see a lot of the patients, particularly with thoracolumbar injuries, that also may have an abdominal injury or a vascular injury, making them hemodynamically unstable. And as Dr. Phalanx was just saying, certainly the circulation and hemodynamic stability always takes precedence. So we would manage those first, and that'd be the biggest reason that in that level one trauma center that we would need a delay.
And another question I have is, so we know that for ASIA scale, like a lot of the practical for ASIA scale, like you, textbook says you determine ASIA grade 72 hours. So how do you determine the improvement is that you see after the early surgical intervention is because of the early surgical intervention, not because the spinal shock or the spinal, some kind of recovery itself?
Yeah, so the question you're raising is sort of in the catch-22 of trying to do research in this area. But I think it's important to recognize that the ASIA examination was originally developed by physiatrists, by rehab physicians, to determine at the time of transfer to the rehab hospital from the acute care unit what the trajectory of recovery would look like over the course of 6 months to a year, and what the care needs would be. And so for that, the assessment was done around 2 weeks after injury, and you can get a pretty accurate idea how the patient is going to be doing. The way we as spine surgeons or acute care clinicians use the ASIA examination is entirely different, where you cannot entirely prognosticate on the basis of an examination done in the first 24 hours how the patient will do, because the physiology of the injury is varying the impact of surgery. But we're using the examination to classify in an objective way the neurological status. We are not using it to predict what the care requirements will be at a year. And that's a very important distinction. But what's important in many of the studies that have been done on the role of early surgery is that has been controlled for. So for example, in Staskis, all of the patients had the ASIA examination within 24 hours, and then there was a choice to delay the surgery or not to delay the surgery. So you're comparing apples with apples. It would not be fair to compare an ASIA examination done in 24 hours versus an ASIA examination done at 2 weeks, and that has been part of the problem with some of the literature.
One additional comment I'd make on timing is that I think the timing options available are different in a level one trauma center versus maybe a community hospital. And that needs to be an important consideration, especially for the ultra early component of it. I think in most centers, one could follow the Staskis findings and try to operate on a patient within 24 hours. But we're talking about the middle of the night patient who presents. I think that there are potentially additional risks in, let's say, having a circulating or scrub team that has no familiarity with spinal instruments, or that you may not have neuromonitoring available. And some of those very practical issues are important in considering whether or not to do an ultra early case outside of a level one trauma center.
I almost feel that the ASIA scale, the neurologic examination has its huge limitations. Because like, for example, the ASIA-E or ASIA-A, the complete spinal cord injury patient, they're different kinds of complete spinal cord injury. They have preserved functional connections in their spinal cord. They just don't have functions. Some has complete disruption of the axons. So is there any way to differentiate those two patients? Because that ideally, conceptually, the treatment will be different.
It's not easy to differentiate those individuals. Some of the clues relate to the mechanism of injury, so and the fracture pattern. So, for example, an individual with a high velocity injury, say high velocity motor vehicle accident, may be thrown from the vehicle with a bilateral facet dislocation, ASIA A. That is a bad injury. That is a poor prognosis for recovery. And then there are some imaging characteristics on MRI, as you know. So the presence of hemorrhage on the MRI showing a severe contusion does correlate with the outcome. However, I would argue that particularly for cervical patients, even in individuals with a very severe injury do benefit from early surgical decompression. So we have some emerging data that shows that even if patients don't convert their ASIA scale, so they remain in ASIA A, that there is a functional benefit to early surgical intervention. So we recognize that because of the eloquence of the cervical cord, that a recovery of each level confers with it additional function. It's recognized that on average, the natural history of an ASIA A cervical patient, regardless of treatment, is that they will tend to recover one ASIA level, particularly in the zone of partial preservation. Recovery of two or more levels is a substantial improvement and is unusual based on the natural history. And so we have unpublished data that we're putting together for publication that does show that early surgical intervention, again defined within 24 hours, does statistically significantly increase the rate of conversion on the ASIA scale by two or more levels, where you gain two or more levels. So if you say if somebody coming in with a C5 level and they emerge with a C7 or C8 level, they've recovered substantial hand function. And so that is an associated benefit, even if they don't convert their Asia grade. And I think that we need to start thinking a bit differently in terms of what types of neurological recovery might reflect an improvement. And this is why the clinical trials that we're seeing are increasingly focusing a lot on patients with cervical injuries, because relatively small amounts of improvement, say in terms of the levels of injury, the amount of tissue that you're able to protect, can make a big difference from a functional perspective.
I think that's an excellent point, and we briefly conversed about that last week at the Academy meeting. And just to reiterate that in different words, a patient in your example goes from Asia A, neurological level of injury, let's say C5 to C8, and they're still Asia A. And so if we're only measuring AIS conversion, we're not going to pick that up on an outcome measure, but the patient is potentially significantly better from a functional perspective. So should we instead be looking at upper extremity motor score totals or upper extremity motor score plus lower extremity motor score? Would that be a better outcome measure for these different trials?
Yeah. So Rajiv, you saw the talk that I gave at the Academy meeting last week, and I talked about that specifically. So talking about the upper extremity motor scores. And this has been one of the problems with how we look at central cord injury. So everyone is saying, oh, the patient is walking, they have a great outcome. Yeah, but you're not looking at their hands. And, if somebody's hands don't work well, they're not happy with the outcome. That has a huge impact. And so I think for cervical cord injury, the money, if you will, is looking at upper extremity function in detail. And I suspect if we look at that, this will more sensitively enable us to discern improvements that occur with various interventions, be it surgery or biologics or drugs.
So Dr. Fillings, you're the pioneer for the treatment for spinal cord injury. So in your impression, what's the most promising strategy right now for the pharmacological treatment for preserving those functions, so increasing the preservation of those functions, or improve the functions after spinal cord injury?
Well, thank you for the compliment. I was trained by somebody that I considered to be the pioneer, who's Charles Tatter, so that's a compliment. Thank you. Yeah, so there are a number of therapies that I think are of interest. So I've just completed a trial that we're now analyzing, looking at the sodium glutamate antagonist riluzole, and I think this drug does show promise. We had a pre-planned interim analysis that did suggest a positive effect, which is now triggered the final analysis, so we'll see. There are some other therapies that are under investigation. So cooling continues to be, a topic of interest and controversy. The challenge with cooling right now is that systemic hypothermia carries with it risks, as we've seen in the traumatic brain injury field. But if we had ways to locally cool the cord that was safe and easy to use, that could be interesting. And there are technologies that are being developed around local hypothermia. So stay tuned. I think that looks interesting. And then the Japanese are looking at a molecule called GECSF. This is a cytokine that mobilizes mesenchymal stem cells. And they have some evidence in early clinical phase studies to suggest that there may be some interesting benefits to that. Minocycline has been examined. This is a tetracycline analog. And there were some modest benefits that were seen in a phase 1/2a trial. Unfortunately, those were not borne out in a subsequent randomized trial, which has been closed. On an emerging level, there's a lot of interest in RO-ROC inhibitors. So RO-ROC is a key pathway that is involved in axonal guidance, and activation of RO will prevent growth cones from reaching their target. So that's been an area of interest. RGMA is an interesting target, and there's now a trial sponsored by AbbVie looking at anti-RGMA. So that is certainly of interest. And then I think the area of biomaterials is interesting, particularly to try to bridge severe deficits. So there's some early work that's being done with scaffolds. That's now, there's a phase three trial that's underway for severe thoracic injuries. Injectable, self-assembling nanoparticles are quite interesting as a biomaterial approach, and they may be complementary to other strategies to repair and regenerate the cord. And then cellular therapies, I think, are of enormous interest. And we've really seen an evolution. So we've kind of gone from Schwann cells, which is really, apart from that, and olfactory and sheathing cells, those are the only way to, say, have autologous cells that would be reasonably safe. We've gone from that to neural stem cells of an allogeneic nature. And what I see next happening is what I would refer to as next generation stem cells. And so these are kind of personalized neural stem cells. The technology exists now to derive these from non-embryonic sources, so induced pluripotent stem cells, or reprogramming potentially, if you could ramp up the technology to get these from an autologous source, and then to engineer these cells so that they express various factors to alter the microenvironment. So this is like really exciting stuff that is down the pipeline. And then, you know, other strategies to complement the regenerative strategies. So local electrical stimulation to try to activate circuits is, you know, potentially an interesting strategy. And then I think what's also important is that to intensify rehabilitation. So targeted intensive rehabilitation to complement the regenerative approaches. And I think it's increasingly recognized that if you only put the stem cells into the cord and then you don't have a targeted rehab program, it's difficult for those stem cells to form the circuits in the cord. And so, you know, kind of looking at combinatorial types of, you know, types of approaches. The role of surgery, we've been talking about this, but what does, adequate surgery, consist of? So I think looking at surgical protocols, we have, say, post-op MRIs to evaluate the effectiveness of surgery. There are some groups, such as Papadopoulos' group in the United Kingdom, that are advocating duroplasties. I think that will need to be validated in trials. So I think the bottom line here is that there's a tremendous amount of translational research that is that's emerging, and this is a very exciting area for young investigators to get involved with. And I think this shows tremendous promise for the future of spinal cord injury.
For a patient who was interested in knowing about some of these emerging therapies and about when they might be available, what would you say about when might something like that be available to a spinal cord injury patient, and which of those do you think is likely to be available first as a treatment option?
Yeah, it's when an individual sustains a spinal cord injury, they're in an absolute state of shock initially, and it's difficult for people to rationalize what's going on. I think the greatest opportunity of intervention is as early as possible. And this is why multidisciplinary focused care, getting the patient to a top center, makes sense. And early surgical intervention, if it can be done safely, makes sense. And then a neuroprotective treatment to try to mitigate the effects of secondary injury. And then seeing how the patient is and rehabbing the patient, and that to me is real, and that is something that we can do now. And I think in the next 5 years we will have a neuroprotective treatment that will complement what we're doing in the acute phases. And then when I see the role of regenerative medicine or ways to try to augment the function of the nervous system, say with electrical stimulation, this is when the patient's coming back to you, say at 3 months, and despite your best efforts, there hasn't been a lot of recovery. And at 3 months, you can pretty well predict what the trajectory of recovery is. And you know, you could have an intelligent conversation with that person around the pros and cons of another type of a strategy. So would a stem cell transplantation make sense in such an individual? And that's kind of where I see things going. And I do see that that all of these types of strategies will be emerging in about the next 5 years.
So as an investigator, what the biggest challenge you face for enrolling the patient into the spinal cord injury trials, and for the people who want to get into that field, what's the suggestion or recommendation you have for them?
Yeah, so spinal cord injury is one of the toughest areas, I think, in all of medicine to study in terms of clinical trials. So advice for the young, young investigator. Well, prospective collection of data is a value. I think this was shown in the Staskis study. I tried to do a randomized trial, and I was unable to for logistical and also ethical reasons. We just couldn't randomize patients for early versus late surgery. And we went to Plan B, which is prospective collection of data, and we got a lot closer to answering the question. It's not perfect, but we got a lot closer. So I would say that the prospective collection of data is really valuable, and then the participation in networks. And so these networks are forming, and so the collation of data, to kind of have a big database, so big data analytics, can be of tremendous value. And so we can learn a lot from that. And that's doable. It's very doable now. In terms of the enrollment in trials, there are certain interventions that absolutely need to be studied with a randomized trial. So a novel drug, a novel biologic, you need a control arm for this. So the acute patients are the hardest ones to enroll because you're fighting the time barrier. And so I think here it's very important that systems are in place to try to get the patients into academic centers where these studies are being done. And I think that this concept of time is spine, where early surgical intervention can help improve recovery, can also help this, okay, because you have to drive the mechanisms in place. What I see emerging will be more trials for patients in the early and then late chronic phases of injury. And there, the logistics of doing trials will be easier. And this is really going to be the field of regenerative medicine. And so I think the big impact of regenerative medicine will be in the early to late chronic phases where, despite everyone's best efforts, there just hasn't been a lot of recovery, and a patient has a devastating impact. What can you do for that, for that patient? And given where the science is going, this is no longer a pipe dream. That this will be a reality. And so from that perspective, the logistics of doing trials will be much easier. So you're not going to need to have sample sizes of like 300 to 400 patients, because the variability in the outcomes will be much less. You'll be dealing with patients who have plateaued in their recovery, and there where you can look at the improvements.
And the patient are generally a lot more willing to participate in those trials because they already passed the phase. Initial, I encountered the problem with the initial acute enrollment the patient is in the shock stage and very hard for them to process all the information because those trials have a laundry list of requirements. It's very hard for the patient to process those.
It is for sure. I would say I've personally found that most patients and families are quite open to going into trials, but you do encounter resistance to this. Certainly, the patients that are coming to you after the initial shock of injury is worn off can make an intelligent, informed choice, which does facilitate the discussions.
So I think we'll stop there. That was a very interesting, exciting discussion. And thank Dr. Failings, Dr. Liu for joining us. And thanks to our audience for participating and listening. And we'll be putting out more content that you can look for in a podcast form from the NAS section on spinal cord injury. Thank you.